This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, Norman Swan here with this week's Health Report. Welcome. Today, a common, disabling, underdiagnosed and undertreated condition.
I felt like I'd started to sound like a little old lady with a tremulous sort of a voice that didn't sound confident, and I hated that.
That's dysphonia. More on that later. Plus, evidence that keyhole surgery on the knee for wear and tear is no better than physio. And cystitis, bladder infection. It's the bane of many women's lives, particularly when they're younger. It's painful and has been likened to passing razor blades. Some women have repeated episodes of cystitis and consume a lot of antibiotics with all the problems that can cause, including thrush, as if the cystitis wasn't enough. But now, thanks to a recent trial, it's now known that common advice to drink more water can actually work. The lead author was Thomas Hooton, an infectious disease specialist at the University of Miami. I spoke to him before we went to air.
It's been thought that one of the body's main defense mechanisms against a urinary tract infection is just urinating the organisms out. Bacteria, when they enter the bladder, have to stick to the bladder lining. And so if you can flush them out, and if you're drinking more fluids, you're diluting the urine so that there's less opportunity for a given bacteria to stick to the cell. That's the reason we think that increased hydration is effective. There's some studies to show that women with recurrent UTI are more likely to delay urination, but there's never been a study looking at increased water in a randomized trial.
That delayed urination, is that fear or is that simply that's what they do?
No, there's some interesting studies from Taiwan. They have these huge factories, and investigators have gone in and asked women who has recurrent urinary tract infection, who does not, and they found that women who do are more likely to hold their urine. And the reason that they give for that is that they're intimidated. They're intimidated. And so there are intervention studies, too, where they try to improve those things so they're not under so much stress. And in fact, they tended to have some improvement.
Now, I'm used to doing interviews from pharmaceutical company-sponsored research. I have to say this is the first one where a water company has, unsurprisingly, I suppose, sponsored this research.
Danone asked me a few years ago about doing such a study. You know, that's pretty neat because if you think about it, this is a little bit different than a company that has a proprietary drug. In this case,
you can just turn on the tap rather than buying a bottle of Evian.
Exactly right. Water is water.
So what did you do and what did you find?
Well, this is a study looking at whether increased water made a difference in terms of reducing the risk of recurrent UTI. So the study design simply is looking at women who have a pretty high risk of recurrent UTI, three or more in the past year. That's not rare by any stretch. And they had to have reported less than a liter and a half of fluid daily to be eligible for the trial. And they were randomized to one of two arms.
And they were young women, their average age 35.
Anyway, so they were randomized to one of two arms. The control arm, don't do anything different. The other arm was whatever you do, continue that. But in addition to that, add a liter and a half of water a day. They supplied them with 500 ml bottles three times a day. And women, when they had symptoms, they were advised to come in for an evaluation for history and physical and urine cultures and check of the urine osmolality and so forth. And at 6 months and then at 12 months, they had the women come back into clinic, the history and physical, collected a urine specimen again. And what they were looking for with the urine specimens was the osmolality, the concentration of the urine, to see whether people who were assigned to the water group really had a reduced concentration. And then we looked at the UTI rates. Well, in the control group, that didn't change any. In the water group, the number of cystitis episodes decreased by about half. And the number of antimicrobial courses to treat those UTIs, as you would expect, also decreased by half. So in a nutshell, that's what they found, that decreased UTI rates, decreased antibiotic use.
But didn't get rid of it altogether.
Didn't get rid of all. And antibiotics are much more effective, at least for a period of time, until your bowel flora changes and you have to stop taking them because you get diarrhea or C. diff or something like that, or because you start getting breakthrough infections with resistant strains. What we'd like to see people do is put a little bit more emphasis on recommending to women that, look, there are some data that increased hydration reduces your risk. It may or may not reduce it to zero, but at least try it, because it won't cause you the problems that antibiotics can cause. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. Then you go with the antibiotics or whatever else you may want to try.
Good result. And as you say, you can turn on the tap rather than buying bottled water, and you get the advantage of the fluoride in the tapped water.
But there you go.
Just finally, I think it's a question I asked you last time, and I'm going to ask it again, which is, women with recurrent UTI, why do they never study the partner who could well be reinfecting them, and it's not the woman's problem, it's their partner's problem? And I don't think anybody's studied the partner in recurrent cystitis, and you're throwing all these antibiotics at the woman when it may well be the man who's got the urinary tract infection or infection and passing it to the woman.
Well, I'm not sure what answer I gave you before, but I was in Seattle and we did a lot of these studies, we actually tried very hard. And by the way, there are some data, more like case reports or small series, that show that in some cases, the woman who comes in with a UTI, if you look at her male partner, the male partner has that strain in his urine. This is a real hard study to do. Think about it. How do you get the man, before he has sex with the woman, to see whether he has a strain that she, a day or two later, has a UTI? You can't do that study.
You can do a randomized trial of treating the man and seeing whether the UTIs go away in the woman.
Yeah, okay. Well, maybe. But
I'm just giving another NIH grant proposal here.
I hadn't thought of that study, and I'm not sure we'd be able to enroll guys. When we try to do these studies, because we try to do a study in men, we were going to enroll women with recurrent UTIs and enroll their male partners and monitor both of them over time. But we couldn't get any guys to come in. The women could not get their boyfriends or husbands to come in. So we just said, we can't do it.
Deny them sex and then they'll be in like a shot.
I know, right? There's probably ways to do it I hadn't thought of.
So I think we've stretched the friendship with our listening audience to its maximum.
All right.
Thomas Hooden, thanks.
Please be careful what you allow on your program.
Never. Thomas Hooden, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thomas Hooden is Professor of Medicine at the University of Miami. And a bit of a fierty, don't you think? You're listening to the Health Report here on RN, ABC News, CBC Radio across Canada. I'm Norman Swan. If you were to go out onto any main street in Australia and invite 45 or 50-year-olds at random to have an MRI of the knee, a large percentage of them would have a tear in one of their menisci. Those are the slivers of cartilage that sit inside the knee joint, helping to stabilise it and providing an added cushion. And there would be no relationship between the torn cartilage and whether or not the person had knee pain or how much knee pain they had, especially if there's no locking of the knee as a result of the tear. It's known from randomised trials that there's no benefit from knee arthroscopy, that's keyhole surgery, for wear and tear in the knee. In fact, it could speed up deterioration to the point of needing a knee replacement. But what about physio as an alternative to arthroscopy when you know you have a torn cartilage which isn't locking up your knee? That's the trial that Victor van der Graaf and his colleagues in Amsterdam have just reported on. Victor is an orthopaedic surgeon and he's on the line from Amsterdam. Welcome to the Health Report.
Well, good morning. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Pleasure. What did you do in this study?
Yeah, so we performed a large multicenter randomized trial in 9 Dutch hospitals, and we included 320 patients between 45 and 70 years old, and all of them obviously had a meniscal tear. And half of them received surgery, in which we removed the torn part of the meniscus, and the other half received a standardized physical therapy program. And what we did is that we followed them up for 2 years, and we found that after the 2 years, that both groups improved equally in knee function.
So what physiotherapy did they actually have?
Well, they had a program which was made up by a knee-specialized physical therapist. And the program, the main purpose was to strengthen the muscles around the knee.
So the quadriceps, particularly at the front.
Yeah, particularly the quadriceps. And also as part of the program, it had some coordination and balance practices.
And how much physiotherapy did they have?
Well, they had a program of 16 sessions in total of 8 weeks.
And what about complications? Because, you know, surgery has complications. You can get infection. Things don't go as well as you hope. Versus physiotherapy?
Yeah, that's true. So recently a really large study was done and published in The Lancet, and they looked for the complications of surgery after a knee arthroscopy. And because we know these complications do not occur frequently, so what they did, the other study, is that they looked through the database of 700,000 knee arthroscopies, and they found that although they were really infrequent, but it still occurred that the complications were like an infection, of course, but also like a venous thromboembolism, but also the lung embolia. So it could get really severe.
And were there many side effects from the physiotherapy?
Not really. So obviously in both groups, some side effects occurred, but the more severe only occurred in the surgery group.
So this is people, just to remind the listener, this is people who aged 45 and over. They've got a torn meniscus, presumably because the general practitioner did an MRI and found a torn meniscus rather than, you know, so it was, that was a situation in which their meniscus was discovered, I assume.
Well, in the Netherlands, it might work a little bit different, but then a patient has knee pain, and if anything is suspected by the general practitioner, they refer it to the patient to us, to the orthopedic surgeons, and we make the MRI. Sometimes the general practitioner also makes the MRI, but most of the times we make the MRI scan.
So you, so essentially there's just equal benefits of physiotherapy with fewer complications. So why are surgeons still doing arthroscopy when the randomized trials for just simple wear and tear don't seem to do any good compared to placebo, and now there's not much difference with arthroscopy and physical therapy?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and that's something that we really look into. And one reason that we expect for this is that it's, well, hard to change the long-held belief. And one argument that we hear quite a lot from surgeons is that they believe that, well, they are able to predict how a patient that's sitting in front of him or her in the outpatient clinic. And then also the argument comes up that that patient is really different from the patient that's included in the trial.
It's almost comforting that orthopedic surgeons behave the same way the world over.
Well, I'm not really sure about that, but so what I try to say is that they believe that they are able to predict how the patient will respond to surgery. So my patient sitting in front of me, he or she will respond good to surgery.
Despite the fact that the evidence suggests otherwise.
Yeah, exactly.
And just so finally, we haven't got much time left. In some of these trials, people cross over into the other form of therapy. How much crossover was there?
Yeah, so approximately 3 in every 10 patients.
So 3 in every 10 patients who were in the physio group moved into the surgery group.
Yes.
And do we know why?
What we found out is that, well, in 3 of every 10 patients, they still needed surgery because of knee pain, obvious, sometimes also because of knee locking that occurred. And currently we're working on a project to identify some patient characteristics which help us to predict the outcome of the conserved treatment. So if we can find certain characteristics that predict, well, let's say a negative outcome of physical therapy, well, then we can adapt the physical therapy program based on those characteristics. And we're not really sure why, but that's something that we currently look into.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thanks so much.
Victor van der Graaf is in the Department of Orthopaedic Surgery at the OLVG Hospital in Amsterdam. And a word of advice, the gold standard first-line test for investigating uncomplicated knee pain in people over 45 or 50 is a weight-bearing ordinary X-ray, not a CT and not an MRI. Having one of those tests just shows up things you were never meant to see and which make unnecessary and potentially harmful treatment more tempting. So don't let yourself be tempted. Earlier this year, we ran a segment on presbyphonia. That's where your voice starts to degrade as you get older. But for some people, it's not age that triggers problems with their voice. It's overuse, infection, and even psychological trauma. The umbrella term for these voice disorders is dysphonia. Sometimes you can completely lose your voice out of the blue, and it can be devastating, as the Health Report's James Bullen reports.
It was a tricky time when I started to notice that words were dropping out when I was speaking. By nature, I'm a chatterbox. I'm somebody who speaks a lot generally, but also in my work, and noticed that words were starting to disappear or be cut off.
That's Louise Bale, president of the Australian Dysphonia Network, describing the start of her voice disorder 13 years ago.
I felt like I'd started to sound like a little old lady with a tremulous sort of a voice that didn't sound confident. And I hated that because inside I'm thinking I'm too intelligent, I'm smart, and I'm not able to show that. So I sought an opinion by an ear, nose and throat doctor who then referred me to a speech pathologist after ruling out that I had no nodules or anything that was obvious. So I saw a speech pathologist for about 6 months, and it was at the end of that that she said she felt certain that I had a condition called spasmodic dysphonia. I have to say I work in the health system. I was originally a registered nurse and have worked in all facets of health for almost 40 years, but this was something I'd never heard of, and I think I could safely say I know more about voice disorders now than anyone really needs to know, having been affected, but no, never heard about it.
So what is dysphonia? I spoke to Dr. Daniel Novakovic and Dr. Kate Medill, co-directors of the new Dr. Liang Voice Program at the University of Sydney, to find out.
Dysphonia is actually, it's a medical term for a voice problem. So it's not actually a diagnosis. People often present to us complaining of hoarseness or loss of voice, and it might mean having a rough or different sounding voice or having a croaky voice. Sometimes the voice can sound normal, but people can be using increased effort.
About 30% of people will experience a voice disorder in their lifetime. It will be dependent on whether you are a professional voice user. If you're a teacher, you're much more likely to have a voice disorder. We know that most people don't seek treatment. It's a highly underdiagnosed and undertreated disorder. It has a very big impact on quality of life. It has a big impact on people's finances and ability to work. And it costs the community a lot of money. In teachers alone in Australia, it's very conservatively estimated to cost over $60 million a year.
Louise Bale has found dysphonia takes a social and emotional toll too.
There are some common themes across anybody that lives with a voice disorder that still become really frustrating. That is not being able to speak up and have an opinion, being caught in a conversation where you constantly get overlooked because you can't compete with a number of voices at the same time. Speaking in a noisy background like a coffee shop or a bar becomes really hard. Most people with a voice issue will notice that the harder they try to speak, the more difficulty have, and so it's really important to have calm, quiet environments. So that impacts on the social life terribly.
Getting a voice disorder diagnosed can be difficult because a doctor's first port of call is usually laryngitis. That's inflammation of the voice box because of overuse or infection. That's down to a lack of awareness of voice disorders, according to Dr. Kate Medill. Plus, doctors have to look for the most likely problem first. And voice disorders are complex. They can have multiple causes and share symptoms with other conditions. There's two broad categories, functional disorders and organic disorders. Dr. Daniel Novakovic.
An organic disorder is where we see a problem with the system that's structural. So we might have a lump or a bump growing on a vocal cord. We might have a neurological weakness. So one of the nerves might be weak, for example, after a stroke or after damage to one of the nerves. Or alternatively, we can have a problem with the control systems of the brain that make the voice not work properly.
In functional disorders, everything looks totally fine. There's no physical problem. But something about the way the person is using their voice isn't quite right. Louise Bale has spasmodic dysphonia. that falls into the first category, an organic disorder, and it's to do with the brain's systems of coordination and movement, though we don't fully understand what causes it. It means the vocal cords can spasm and close, making the voice tighten or suddenly break. But Louise has found some relief in an unlikely place.
The gold standard of treatment internationally is Botox injections, which is injected into the muscles that control the vocal folds. And the Botox actually reduces the amount of overactivity in those muscles and stops them from spasming. I'm at the sweet spot in my Botox treatment, and I have the injections about every 3 to 4 months.
Spasmodic dysphonia is one of those conditions that we don't have a good cure for. There have been various treatments over the years, and to date, the most effective treatment has been the use of muscle-relaxing injections such as botulinum toxin into the muscles that are too tight. Now, this is not a cure, and this doesn't last long-term. It needs to be repeated over time, and it gives a symptomatic relief.
Aside from Botox, some voice disorders can be treated with surgery or even voice retraining. Dr. Kate Medill says some disorders may be linked to psychological conditions where underlying trauma has to be resolved before the voice returns.
This is a group that we don't really understand very well. We need to do a lot more research. And Dr. Novakovic will look at their vocal cords. They'll be moving completely normally. They're very healthy. In those types of cases, we need to see those people very quickly because we need to get the voice working. And we have therapeutic interventions, exercises to try and trick the voice into coming back. And this is an area of voice disorders that's quite fascinating. It's under-researched and poorly understood.
But Louise Bale says support is just as important as treatment.
People who are affected often feel completely isolated, misunderstood by their partner, their family, their friends, and their workplace.
As president of the Australian Dysphonia Network, Louise hopes to connect people with the condition so they can share their stories.
I think generally people say, well, you know, you're not dying, you don't have cancer, there are a lot of people a lot worse off. That's true, but when so much of your personality and your identity is rolled up in your voice, losing it's pretty shattering and I think isolating. So the network provides a place for people to, I guess, get that support and to feel like they're doing something to make it different.
Louise Bell ending that report from James Bullen. The Australian Dysphonia Network is having a voice disorders forum in Sydney on October 27th. Details on the Health Report website. Most Australians can't remember a time when we didn't have universal healthcare, by which I mean that we as a nation provide high-quality healthcare regardless of ability to pay, at least in hospitals, if not always in the community. First introduced as Medibank by the Whitlam government, then progressively dismantled until it was reintroduced as Medicare in 1984 by the Hawke government. Well, last week, the co-designer of both schemes died. His name was John Deeble, born in Wimmeran, Victoria, left school at 15, yet became a leading economist who worked initially at the University of Melbourne and then at the Australian National University. Someone who knew John Deeble well was the health minister who brought in Medicare, Neil Blewett, who's on the line now. Welcome back to the Health Report, Neil. It's been a while.
Been a while, Norman, yes.
What was John Deeble's vision?
Well, I think that he and Scotton originally recognised very clearly that the best solution to access problems in the Australian health system was to go for a system of public health insurance. We weren't able to go down the British path because of the civil conscription of doctors provision in the Constitution. So that path was closed to us, and it was Deeble and Scotton who came up with a proposal for a public health insurance system known originally as Medibank.
Dick Scotton being the person you're talking about.
Yes.
So how far from the vision that you took up in 1984 was it from Deeble's vision, or was it in Deeble and Scotton's vision that you implemented?
Well, it was very much the Deeble-Scotton vision. They'd, after Whitlam fell from power and the Medibank scheme was finally undermined by Fraser, there was considerable argument into the Labour Party which way we should go. And it was primarily Bill Hayden, John Deeble, and to a lesser extent myself, that persuaded the party that we should rebuild Medibank. That is, basically, we should use the model that had been provided to Whitlam in the late 1960s.
And you've no doubt been observing since. You're a political scientist. How far is Medicare now with all the changes? And it has to be said it has bipartisan support now, at least it seems so, from what you implemented in 1984?
Well, first of all, it has survived. But I think in recent years, and John would be the first to have commented on this, it's been rather subtly undermined by the efforts to build up private health insurance. I mean, the original vision in Medicare when it was introduced was that private health insurance would supplement Medicare, cover the things that Medicare did not cover. But what has happened in the last decade has been, as I say, a subtle undermining, whereby there have been governmental efforts, not that successful, but they've constantly tried to prop up private health insurance so that in some ways there is a danger of it becoming an alternative to Medicare. That is, if you've got private health insurance, you tend to use that system. If you've only got Medicare, only basic cover, then you've got the other system. It's not as clear as that yet, but that is the kind of two-tier system that there are signs of developing.
And would that have troubled John Deeble?
It certainly troubled him, and many of my last conversations with him were about this matter, because he had always argued against there being one system for the well-off and another system for the less well-off.
He was accused of being an ideologue at the time, particularly by the AMA. I mean, you had open warfare with the AMA. Was he an ideologue?
No, not at all. I mean, he was very much a professional health economist, one of the first of his tribe. Health economy is a relatively late discipline. And he was governed by, above all, by the facts and the evidence. And everything he did was based on evidence and statistics. I mean, I've just recently read perhaps his last major lecture, Chalmers oration he gave, I think, in 2009, and all of his qualities, the objectivity, the use of evidence, looking at the facts. It's very unfair to describe as an ideologue.
And, of course, he helped to set up other academic institutions in terms of the study of health services.
That's right. He had a major contribution in Canberra. And he wasn't just a single ideas man. He's done some very interesting work on better ways of to work out how we can depreciate hospital buildings, capital equipment in hospitals, a very important issue, and there's been a lot of problems with it. And he did a lot of very fine work, I think, in developing a better system of depreciation of those assets.
Neil, thank you very much for joining us. I think his funeral service is this Friday.
Yeah, and I hope to be there because it's a great loss to health policy in this country.
Neil Blewett, who was the health minister in the Hawke government, which brought in Medicare in 1984. I'm Norman Swan. This has been the Health Report. Look forward to your company next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.